From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
February 1993, of course, was the bombing of the World Trade Center, about 30 days after Clinton was sworn in. And he made several decisions at that time which had long-range effects and on the war on terror and on that he waged.
As President Bush addresses the United Nations, we'll spend the hour looking at the roots of 9-1-1, at Osama bin Laden, at how much the U.S. government knew in the years before September 11th. We'll host a debate between two investigative reporters. Richard Miniter wrote the book Losing Bin Laden, How Bill Clinton's Failures Unleash Global Terror. And Peter Lance, former correspondent for ABC News, wrote 1,000 Years for Revenge, International Terrorism and the FBI, The Untold Story.
You did was you did a disservice to the current debate by focusing this only on Clinton. The fact of the matter is that the president's father, George Herbert Walker Bush, it was on his watch that the FBI had the greatest opportunity to first stop Ramzi Youssef and also ultimately stop 9/11.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Guardian of London is reporting UN Secretary General Kofi Annan will openly challenge the White House doctrine of preemptive military attacks today on the floor of the United Nations shortly before President Bush addresses the General Assembly. Annan's expected to accuse the U.S. of using, quote, lawless use of force. Annan will say the logic of preemptive attacks, quote, represents a fundamental challenge to the principles on which, however imperfectly, world peace and stability have rested for the last 58 years. Bush is expected to defend his decision to invade Iraq without UN backing. Bush told Fox News, "I will make it clear that I made the right decision and that the others that joined us made the right decision." Bush is also expected to announce his support for UN involvement in the writing of an Iraqi constitution and the oversight of elections. Ahmed Chalabi, the president of Iraq's interim government, has broken with the Bush administration and called for the Iraqi Governing Council to be given at least partial control of Iraq's finance and security ministries. This, according to a report in the New York Times, the paper reports Chalabi is also attempting to get the UN to grant sovereign status for the unelected 25-member Governing Council, a move Washington opposes. French President Jacques Chirac has also called for the UN to oversee a two-stage plan to transfer sovereignty to the Iraqi Governing Council. The White House opposes the plan. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice said yesterday the French calls for an immediate handover were not going to work. Meanwhile, two UN food agencies said today about half of the Iraqi population of 25 million is still in need of food assistance. The Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Food Program blamed the U.S. invasion and years of economic sanctions and drought. Agence France-Presse is reporting Iraq's Governing Council is preparing to temporarily expel the Arabic television networks Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya, charging the stations are guilty of incitement of violence in their reporting about Iraq. The Federal Communications Commission yesterday approved the creation of a new Spanish-language media giant by approving the $3.5 billion merger of the television company Univision Communications and the radio company Hispanic Broadcasting. The FCC's vote was 3-2, with the commissioners taking the same sides they did 3 months ago when they approved the rewriting of the nation's media ownership laws to allow for greater media consolidation. 3 Republicans to 2 Democrats. The Bush administration is attempting to use the USA Patriot Act to deport 2 Palestinian Americans for their actions 16 years ago when, as students, they allegedly raised money for the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. In 1987, the Reagan administration attempted to bar the 2 men, Khader Hamideh and Michel Shahada, and 6 others on the grounds that they were connected to a communist group. The men became known as the LA 8. They were never deported because a federal appeals court declared the anti-communist law to be unconstitutional. The Washington Post reports at the time FBI Director William Webster conceded the men would never have been arrested if they were U.S. citizens, and he concluded they never took part in terrorist activity. But now the Washington Post reports the Bush administration is claiming the men broke the Patriot Act of 2001, which retroactively made it a crime to supply material support to organizations the government deems to be terrorist. Their attorney, David Cole, a professor at Georgetown University Law, said, quote, "This has always been a case of guilt by association and nothing more." Attorney General John Ashcroft is making it tougher for federal prosecutors to strike plea bargains with criminal defendants. In a memo sent to all 94 U.S. attorneys' offices yesterday, Ashcroft ordered federal prosecutors to pursue maximum criminal charges and sentences whenever possible, and to seek lesser penalties through plea bargains only in limited circumstances. A past president of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers said the change, quote, creates a system that is not only inflexible and problematic, but becomes a sort of immovable object. You're adding more unfairness to the system. During the summer, Ashcroft instructed U.S. attorneys to seek the death penalty whenever applicable and announced a plan last month to track data on judges who give lighter sentences than recommended by federal guidelines. Newsweek has released a poll showing former General Wesley Clark, who announced his run for the White House last week, would beat President Bush in a head-to-head race, 49-46% margin. Clark polled better than his 9 Democratic counterparts. In other campaign news, Senator Carol Mosley Brown, who is the only African-American woman to serve in the U.S. Senate, officially declared her candidacy for president yesterday, calling for a, quote, partnership for peace, prosperity, and progress. In California, a panel of 11 judges from the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals are expected to rule today whether the gubernatorial recall election should be held next month or postponed until March. The highest levels of the Air Force leadership knew a decade ago that the Air Force Academy was suffering from a major sexual misconduct crisis but failed to take effective action. That's the conclusion of a report released yesterday by an independent panel investigating sexual assault at the academy. In Afghanistan, Agence France-Presse is reporting the Taliban are now officially retaking control of 4 districts in southeast Afghanistan where they form committees to organize resistance against U.S.-led forces. The United States has agreed to lend Turkey $8.5 billion though officials are denying the money is contingent on Turkey sending 10,000 troops to Iraq, as requested by Washington. The nation's capital region is still suffering the aftermath of Hurricane Isabel, as over 1 million people remain without power for a 4th consecutive day. And this news from USA Today. A toxic chemical used to make furniture, foam, and electronics fire-resistant is turning up in high amounts in the breast milk of women in the United States. The USA Today says the 2 studies, one out today, found that all of the women tested were contaminated with polybrominated diphenyl ethers. Their PBDE levels were the highest in the world, 10 to 20 times higher than those in Europe, where the chemicals are being phased out. Spiritual by John Coltrane. He was born on this date, 1926, in Hamlet, North Carolina. He would have been 77 years old today. and you are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush is scheduled to address the United Nations today on Iraq and defend his decision to invade without UN backing. In an exclusive interview, not surprisingly, with Rupert Murdoch's Fox News, Bush told the news organization, quote, "I will make it clear that I made the right decision and that the others that joined us made the right decision." Bush is also expected to announce his support for UN involvement in the writing of an Iraqi constitution and the oversight of elections. The Associated Press reported Sunday that the alleged mastermind of the September 11th attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was captured in Pakistan in March, told U.S. interrogators al-Qaeda had originally planned to hijack 5 commercial jets on each U.S. coast. The operation, originally developed in 1996, was scaled down at the request of Osama bin Laden, he said, to improve the chances that the attacks could be pulled off simultaneously. Mohammed also divulged that in its final stages, the hijacking plan called for as many as 20 about Osama bin Laden. How much the government reporter Peter Lance, former correspondent for ABC News, 5-time Emmy Award-winning reporter. His new book is called 1,000 Years for Revenge, International Terrorism and the FBI, The Untold Story. Peter Lance joined us in our studio recently, and on the phone with us was Richard Miniter, also an investigative reporter who wrote the book Losing Bin Laden, How Bill Clinton's Failures Unleashed Global Terror. Well, I began by asking Richard Miniter to lay out his case for why he seems to argue that most of the blame for the failure to stop the 9/11 attacks can be put on the shoulders of Bill Clinton.
Well, I don't know if I would say that that Bill Clinton is solely responsible for 9/11. I think he's part of the picture, but I wouldn't say that he's entirely to blame. The threat, the Bin Laden threat, really emerged on Bill Clinton's watch. December 29th, 1992, was the first time in which bin Laden targeted Americans. And that was while George Bush was still president, but after Clinton had won the election and just shortly before he was going to be sworn in as president. In two towering hotels in Yemen, 100 U.S. Marines were stationed, and bin Laden's plan was to blow up both of those towers, and he nearly succeeded but was foiled by a sharp-eyed security guard, and so no one was injured. Everyone has sort of forgotten about this 1992 incident in Yemen, but that was the first time the CIA learned of bin Laden, and it was the first time also that Clinton or any president was briefed on bin Laden. February 1993, of course, was the bombing of the World Trade Center, about 30 days after Clinton was sworn in. And he made several decisions at that time which had long-range effects and on the war on terror and on that he waged. One of those decisions was to put the investigation entirely into the hands of the FBI to treat it like a criminal matter. That meant that effectively that the CIA was shut out of the investigation, as were other intelligence agencies. So it was not treated like a counterterrorism operation, but like a crime. And that had important effects, two of which were this. One was that the FBI was not able to compare notes with the CIA, which had files on the overseas activities of many of the people who were being investigated in connection with the bombing. CIA Director Jim Woolsey told me how frustrated he was by that, because any junior agent in the New York office of the FBI knew far more about the first major terrorist attack on foreign terrorist attack on U.S. soil than he did. It was and he was not able to then connect a lot of the dots. And the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, which is typically run, the deputy of which is typically an FBI official, which is supposed to coordinate all these activities, was also cut out of the loop. And important effects as well, because the CIA, the FBI's New York office, while, you know, usually does take the lead in counterterrorism activities, didn't have access to the CIA's international information. So it relied on an informant named Ali Mohammed. Ali Mohammed would later turn out to be a double agent, simultaneously an informant, a source for the FBI, and working for bin Laden. And he was passing on tremendous amounts of information from the FBI investigation that he was given by investigators who believed him to be very helpful to bin Laden. He also translated U.S. Army warfare manuals into Arabic and passed them on to bin Laden. On his vacations, he would go and train bin Laden's bodyguards and help surveil embassies in across Africa, U.S. embassies, that would be later be targeted for attack. The CIA knew that Ali Mohammed was a bin Laden operative, but didn't know that he was an informant for the FBI. The FBI did not know that he was a bin Laden operative, but thought of him as a very, very helpful and knowledgeable man. This is the problem when you don't allow communication, and of course communication is virtually illegal if it's a criminal investigation because of rules of evidence and so on. And the ability to grasp that the terrorism is not a crime but an act of war meant that it took a very long time for the Clinton administration to put together the pieces. Now, to be fair, we had not been the target in the United States of an ongoing terrorist attack. We weren't having the experience that the Germans, the French, and the Italians had starting in the late 60s. So we had our government had very little understanding, and there was a learning curve there about terrorism. But still, that decision would turn out to be very fateful. I'm sure Mr. Lance could probably speak more authoritatively on that. He's written a fantastic and well-written book on the FBI.
Well, let's take on some of these issues. We're speaking with Richard Miniter, who's written the new book, Losing Bin Laden, How Bill Clinton's Failures Unleashed Global Terror. Peter Lance.
Richard, first of all, thanks for the compliment. I do appreciate it. And I recommend your book as well as Gerald Posner's book, which is out right now, because all people have to get educated if they're going to understand the threat as it existed and as it still exists. But I have to take exception with your general thesis, because I think while a lot of what you have to say is true, and I especially agree with your notion of that they treated this as a series of legal cases as opposed to a geopolitical problem, I totally embrace that thesis. I think what you did was you did a disservice to the current debate by focusing this only on Clinton. The fact of the matter is that the president's father, George Herbert Walker Bush, it was on his watch that the FBI had the greatest opportunity to first stop Ramzi Youssef and also ultimately stop 9/11, because one of the revelations in my book is that Ramzi Youssef was the architect of 9/11, and then after he escaped New York, went to the Philippines and with his uncle Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and several of the cohorts, put the 9/11 plot well into motion as early as 1994. There were 6 targets chosen. There were 10 Islamic pilots training in flight schools. And the Philippines authorities that actually uncovered this, Colonel Mendoza, who I interviewed at length, turned all of this information over to the U.S. Embassy in Manila. Now, the U.S. Embassy in Manila, while it had one FBI legat, also had a major CIA presence. So the notion that the CIA was barred from understanding the threat and the potential for 9/11 is just absurd.
Peter Lance, author of 1,000 Years for Revenge, International Terrorism and the FBI, The Untold Story, and Richard Miniter. He wrote the book Losing Bin Laden, How Bill Clinton's Failures Unleashed Global Terror. We'll be back with the two of them in a minute. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to Richard Miniter, author of Losing Bin Laden, How Bill Clinton's Failures Unleash Global Terror, and Peter Lance, 1,000 Years for Revenge, International Terrorism and the FBI, The Untold Story. We return to Peter Lance.
Well, I'd like to go back and talk first about President Senior Bush and his culpability in this matter, and then we can get to his son eventually while we talk about President Clinton, because I agree that the lion's share of the culpability lies during those 8 years of the Clinton administration. But let's look at Senior Bush, if you will.
Well, can I just jump in for 1 second? I'm not saying that Clinton is entirely responsible. The sentence you just uttered, that the lion's share belongs with the Clinton and the Clinton years, I don't even think I'd say that. I would say that he is, I think Clinton and the Clinton administration is largely responsible, but I would not say solely. And
no, I'm not saying that, but
say lion's share. So you may be far more anti-Clinton than I am.
No, I'm not anti-anybody. I'm actually, what I found was culpability that transcended three presidencies, that lies specifically in the New York office of the FBI, and that by politicizing this and doing a history as you did, where you don't mention the senior Bush or essentially the culpability of the incumbent, what happens is you politicize the debate and we don't get anywhere. I want to talk about the first serious lapse on the president's father's during his administration. In 1989, in Calvert and Long Island, on four successive weekends in July, the FBI Special Operations Group, which is the elite black bag unit, the unit that got Gotti, if you will, followed a group of what they called MEs, which is FBI speak for Middle Eastern men, from the El Farouk Mosque on Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn out to Calvert and Long Island. On four weekends, they photographed these men with dozens and dozens of photos, firing automatic weapons, etc. Of that group of men photographed, three of them went on to bomb the World Trade Center. One of them, El Sayed Nosair, went on to kill Rabbi Meir Kahane in 1990. And by the way, that was bin Laden's first attack on America, November 5th, 1990, not the hotel bombings in 92 that you point out. The first attack on an American by essentially a member of a bin Laden cell was the murder of Kahane by Nosair. And Nosair and another member of the Calverton crew, Clement Rodney Hampton L., were later convicted in the plot to blow up the bridges and tunnels around New York. And Ali Mohammed, as you rightfully point out, was their leader. But Ali Mohammed, was actually a triple agent. He was working for the U.S. Special Warfare School at Fort Bragg. He was essentially had been an ex-Egyptian army officer who got into America despite a presence on a watch list, married an American woman, became a naturalized citizen, joined the U.S. Army, and in 1989, while he was serving with the Green Berets at Fort Bragg, as an active duty sergeant in the U.S. Army, he was going up to these paramilitary training sessions and training these men who would terrorize our country. 9 years later, as you point out, Richard, rightfully, he is the guy that actually did the surveillance of the African embassies that killed 234, and he actually took the pictures that bin Laden pointed to and said, here's where we placed the bomb. So as early as the presidency of George Bush Sr., they had these guys on the radar. But the most astonishing thing happened in 1992, also on the watch of George Herbert Walker Bush, and that is FBI agent Nancy Floyd, a young agent in the New York office, recruited an ex-Egyptian army officer named Imad Salem. Salem went undercover, infiltrated the Sheikh's cell, and for $500 a week had uncovered a bombing plot to bomb what they call 12 Jewish locations around New York City. And contrary to what you say in your book, you actually make the statement where you say that the FBI, let me just read quickly, according to official DOJ guidelines and various statutes passed by Congress, agents had to have evidence that a crime had been committed or was underway. Sometimes supervisors would not approve an investigation even if there was evidence of criminal activity. If the crime seemed insignificant, in practical terms, that meant the FBI could investigate terrorists after Americans were dead, but not before. Now, that's patently false. They had the Foreign Counterintelligence Unit recruited Salem. He was undercover. They had a special deal where he would be an asset who wouldn't have to testify. And then Carson Dunbar, a man with zero terrorism experience, experience, took over the terrorism branch, did not like Nancy, did not trust Salem, and basically changed the rules, forced him over the wall to become a criminal informant, and he withdrew. The last thing he said to Nancy Floyd in the fall of 92 was, there's somebody in town building a bomb, I don't know who. That was, of course, now Ramzi Youssef. Please, Nancy, tell the FBI to follow Mohammed Salema and Mahmoud Abulima. These are two of the guys from Calverton from 89. If you follow them, they will lead you to the bomber. And if you do not, don't call me when the bombs go off. Use plural. The day after the bombing, the FBI realized their extraordinary mistake, brought Salem back in and paid him $1.5 million to do what he could have done in the fall for $500 a week. And in 2 months, he wrapped up the entire cell around the Sheikh and the bridge and tunnel plot. So the FBI had all the capability, all the tools. The Patriot Act was unnecessary. This idea that we need all these draconian civil libertarian intrusions today to fight the war on terror is absurd. All of the tools to have stopped Ramzi Youssef and therefore stopped the original bombing and 9/11 were there during the presidency of George Herbert Walker Bush.
Well, despite Mr. Lance's tone, I actually agree with about 95% of what he just said. This is an extraordinary debate. I guess we don't disagree about all that much. It's unfortunate, though, in the case of the murder of Meir Kahan, that the key documents were not translated until years later. The FBI was not, as maybe Mr. Lance is better informed on this than I am, but my understanding is the FBI was not the lead investigator that the New York Police Department was and treated it originally as a hate crime and a murder, not as a political assassination.
That's true, Richard, but they both...
Can I just respond to your
point? Sure, go ahead. I'm sorry.
If you'd let me.
Sure, go ahead.
So that was a bureaucratic bungle, of course. And, of course, the New York Police Department, which once had a very good translation capability, didn't, in this case, translate documents. If they had, they would have discovered that in Nasir's possession were Arabic translations of U.S. Army warfare manuals, which, of course, were collected by Ali Mohammed. You should probably add Ali Mohammed got his visa, even though he's on a watch list, from a CIA official in Cairo. So he was essentially let into the United States by the CIA.
The Blind Sheikh.
That's right. No, not the Blind Sheikh. Well, the Blind Sheikh was also let in... But I was talking about...
No, I know, Ali Mohammed, yeah. Yeah. I understand.
as for the construction of my book, it does not deal with the second Bush administration for the simple reason that that is what my next book is about. The next book is called Bush's Secret War, that you end up with a very long and unwieldy narrative if you begin in the early 90s and go to the present. And
yet this is a very politically strategic book, the one you have now, if you've segmented that out, because this is coming in the time of the election, and it is taking blame off the Bush bookends, senior and junior. And its subtitle is How Bill Clinton's Failures Unleashed Global Terror.
Well, of course, publishers write titles and design covers, not writers. But
do you disagree with that subtitle?
I think it probably overstates the case a little bit, sure. But, look, when you write a book, you want to write a compelling narrative. You want to follow certain people through a course of events, such as one of the people I followed was Richard Clark, the Clinton's counterterrorism czar, and who did make it into the Bush years, the second Bush administration, a little bit, but his role was severely downgraded. And he left, in the middle. So, just to construct the narrative to make it comprehensible to the average reader and interesting, you need to stop it somewhere. The second book, Bush's Secret War, actually picks up almost exactly where this leaves off, and that's appearing in September 2004.
And what do you think President George Bush's culpability is? Since you're sort of framing things in terms of which president is culpable?
Well, I think that there were, in the 8 months, there were between January and September 2001, there were missed opportunities. The retaliation plan that had been left behind by the Clinton administration to retaliate for the attack on the USS Cole did work its way through the Bush bureaucracy And it's one of the interesting bits of history, really, that they had gotten the missile strike on bin Laden's camps approved in August 2001. Condoleezza Rice had signed off on it on September 4th, 2001. And the chief of staff put it on all that remained in order to order a massive missile strike on bin Laden's operations in Afghanistan was the personal approval of the president. They scheduled a meeting with the president for 3 p.m. September 11th. Well, at 9 a.m. that morning, obviously, the world had changed. But they did not realize that they had necessarily had to hurry that process. A lot of key administration officials were not in place. The FBI director, for example, came in the week before 9/11. The Florida vote fiasco meant that a lot of decisions, a lot of key people, they were not decided on by the new administration until much later. The transition was much slower and much more adversarial with the outgoing Clinton administration. Various people were denied briefings, and various Clinton officials who wanted to give briefings to their incoming people were not given them.
Who was refused, and who was who of the Clinton administration attempted to give a briefing on terrorism to the Bush administration, and who refused under George W. Bush?
Now we're talking about a book that...
No, not a book. We're just talking about events.
We're now talking about events. That's one of the scoops in my new book. And I'd
rather it's pretty well known that Richard Clark had attempted to set up a meeting with Condoleezza Rice. But I wanted to talk about
that's
Richard
Clark.
That's
not what we're talking about here. Richard Clark did meet with Susan Rice and...
Condoleezza Rice.
With Condoleezza Rice. And met with her extensively, and she ended up retaining him for a period of time on the National Security Council. So that's not who I'm talking about. But, I'm happy to talk about the Clinton bin Laden years when my next book comes out in September 2004, about 2 months before the presidential election, mind you. We can come back on, and I'll talk extensively about what I've learned about the Bush bin Laden years. And let me just say that I'll be, that book will be as thorough and as critical a piece of reporting as Losing Bin Laden is.
Okay, I want to say a couple of things about the lost opportunities during the second Bush administration. By the year 2001, there were so many dots on the chart, and I have a timeline in the middle of my book, which basically cites almost 150 either lost opportunities of mismanaged intelligence, etc. But by the time 2001 came around, the number of dots were thundering. The drums were pounding so loud. On July 5th, Condoleezza Rice admitted that the threat reporting, she later used the words, had been sufficiently robust. She called it, there was a lot of chatter in the system. Now, this is a gross understatement. Richard Clark, the same day, called a White House meeting with officials of the FBI, FAA, Coast Guard, et cetera, warning, quote, something really spectacular is going to happen here, and it's going to happen soon. The next day, Clark chaired a meeting of the National Security Council's Counter-Security Group, the CSG, and ordered a suspension of all non-essential travel by the staff. The Attorney General, Ashcroft, was told by his staff to only take private planes for the rest of his tenure. The American people had no idea what was going on.
Wait a second. Yeah. Can you just repeat that last point?
Attorney General Ashcroft, during the summer of 2001, was told, because of the level of threat that the intelligence agencies then knew was facing America, not to take commercial air travel.
Well, let me just respond to that. That's been reported widely, but never confirmed by Ashcroft or anybody at the Department of Defense. So,
okay, well, in a minute I can get to some of the things that you talk about in your book that I take exception to, but I want to just talk about the 2001, the summer, how much knowledge they had, how much culpability the Bush administration has. In August 6th, in the presidential daily briefing, the president was warned, essentially, there was a British intelligence report that cited a potential hijacking of a plane to free blind Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman. And he, as I say, runs like a hot circuit cable all the way from Afghanistan with bin Laden in the late 1980s all the way up through 9/11. He was beloved by bin Laden. Bin Laden adopted, effectively, two of his sons. The Cole bombing fatwa 2 weeks before the Cole bombing, where bin Laden wore the dagger, he said, free the blind Sheikh. He had the son of the Sheikh speak. Remember El Sayed Nasser, the guy that killed Kahani. On August 6th, Bob Woodward reported that there was a top secret memo within the presidential daily briefing called Bin Laden Determined to Strike U.S. This is on August 6th, before 6 weeks before 9/11.
But more. That memo. That's not the title of the memo.
More remarkably, on the 6th of September, 5 days before 9/11, the Taliban foreign minister approached the U.S. and offered to exchange the 8 Christian aid workers then being held in Kabul for the blind Sheikh. So the incredible number of dots on the chart were thundering, and yet here's why the American people didn't know. You cite Larry Johnson in your book as one of your experts, Larry C. Johnson. He was a former counterterrorism director of the State Department under both President Bush Sr. and President Clinton. Larry Johnson actually gave an interview to the New York Times in July of 2001, in which he basically said the threat from terrorism is diminishing in America. Unwilling to just embrace that, he went on to do an op-ed piece essentially on June 10th, in which he said the threat from Osama bin Laden has been widely overblown. And this is what the American people sense, the public sense, was that it was business as usual. All of this behind-the-scenes intelligence that was just coming at the administration on multiple levels, the public knew nothing about. And ultimately in history, and maybe you'll report it in your book, but ultimately in history, this current president is going to have to answer those questions. One of the biggest problems, however, has been the president resisted the creation of the 9/11 Commission for months, and he only allowed it to exist when he brokered a deal to have Henry Kissinger and Senator Mitchell chair it. Well, of course, they resigned within days, citing potential conflict of interest. But when the commission issued its report in July, they reported that essentially the Justice Department and the Pentagon were stonewalling them. Only $14 million was initially approved for this commission, which is the equivalent of the Warren Commission, yet $40 million was approved to investigate the Columbia disaster, to give you an idea on perspective. And as you know, Richard, the president, for months and months and months, refused to allow the 858-page report to be seen by the general public. And even then, it came out heavily redacted. So this administration, to this day, has never openly acknowledged its culpability. In fact, Director Mueller, true that he only had a few weeks on the job at the time of 9/11.
But it was 1 week, by the way.
Okay, 1 week. Director Mueller, as late as April 19th of 2002, actually gave a speech in San Francisco in which he said, we haven't found a single piece of paper in our files that would have given us any warning about 9/11. I'm paraphrasing. He then said the same thing in front of Congress a week later. Only after Colleen Rowley...
Any thoughtful person disagrees that Mueller is a political hack in over his head.
Let me finish. Only after Colleen Rowley from the Minneapolis office took him to task did he even begin to talk about reform. So this administration, after 9/11, their entire approach, their major thrust has been, of course, invasion of Afghanistan, invasion of Iraq. It's like their approach to the... You know, fighting the war on terror has been completely military oriented, and the FBI to this day, no one has ever been held accountable for 9/11. This is one of the findings in the Joint Inquiry Report. No one in the FBI, which I basically say in my book, there's blood on the hands of people in the New York office of the FBI. No one has ever been held accountable. The only person who's ever been punished as a result of the failure to stop Yousef in 1992. Was Special Agent Nancy Floyd, who was the object of a 5.5-year internal affairs investigation, OPR, and she was suspended for 2 weeks. Instead of getting a corner office in the Hoover Building for recruiting Ahmad Salem, arguably the greatest asset they've had in the war on terror, she got set up and treated as the scapegoat. So, you know, where's the Bush administration today? Openly cooperating with the 9/11 Commission to get at the bottom of the greatest unsolved mass murder in U.S. history.
Peter Lance, author of 1,000 Years for Revenge, International Terrorism and the FBI, The Untold Story, debating Richard Miniter, author of Losing Bin Laden, How Bill Clinton's Failures Unleashed Global Terror. We'll be back with them here on Democracy Now! And democracynow.org. You can go there and join our Daily Digest mailing list and also watch and listen to Democracy Now! Online. Stay with us. This is John Coltrane, Afro Blue, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with our debate between Richard Miniter, Losing Bin Laden, How Bill Clinton's Failures Unleash Global Terror, and Peter Lance, former correspondent for ABC News, author of 1,000 Years for Revenge, International Terrorism, the FBI, The Untold Story. I started by asking Richard Miniter in this segment of the interview about Vice President Dick Cheney's claim on Meet the Press with Tim Russert last week that that Iraq was the geographic center of terror and the invasion and the bombing of the World Trade Center in 93.
Oh, I don't know that I maintain in my book that Iraq is behind the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. I don't think anyone disagrees that Iraq had been a major funder of terrorism in the Middle East, going back at least until 1969, with their funding of the Baluchi uprisings in Pakistan. And they have a history, frankly, of sponsoring al-Qaeda-related groups, one, of course, in Uganda, which was a member of al-Qaeda's network that had given their bayat, their oath of loyalty to bin Laden, and yet we found the equivalent of canceled checks and things like that in Iraqi archives after the war. Before the war, there was a lot known also about connections between Iraq and al-Qaeda. The Bush administration, in its typically incompetent way, didn't really lay the case out in public view, except perhaps in Colin Powell's speech about these connections. But Egyptian and Sudanese intelligence sources that I've talked to say they observed and photographed meetings between the Iraqi Mukhabarat, that's their external intelligence, one of their three intelligence agencies, and al-Qaeda in meetings in Khartoum, Addis Ababa, Cairo, and other cities. Going back as far as 1993, it appears by 1995 that the relationship had solidified, and as the 90s progressed, Iraq became progressively more impressed by al-Qaeda's organization and funded it to a much greater degree, and also provided its training facilities to al-Qaeda members. And of course, there were training facility at Salman Pak, where they they're able to send operatives to train on the Boeing 707 that was parked there for the purposes of practicing hijacking. But also, the Iraqis were well known to have one of the best document forging and passport forging operations in the Middle East. They had designed that over many years, working with the Stasi, the East German secret police, and a lot of those skills were passed on to al-Qaeda and to other terrorist groups, to Abu Nidal, for example.
Peter Lance, would you agree with this assessment, the connection between Iraq, Saddam Hussein, and Al-Qaeda.
And the Trade Center bombing going back to 90, absolutely not. Richard cites...
I just said they were not, I did not say they were connected to the 93 World Trade Center bombing.
No, but you cite Lori Milroy in your book a couple of times. Lori Milroy is the perpetrator of this...
minor points in which I don't adopt her thesis.
Okay, let me, if you don't mind, Richard. Lori Milroy is the architect of the thesis that helped to justify the invasion of Iraq, which is this myth that Saddam Hussein was somehow connected to Al-Qaeda and had any connection at all to September 11th. When you mentioned the UN, the paper-thin evidence that was presented by Secretary Powell at the UN, he talked about a possible connection to a camp in Kurdistan, which wasn't even held by Saddam, and he talked about a guy who sought medical...
That part of Kurdistan was held by Saddam, by the way.
Yeah. Let me just say, in the 5 years prior to the invasion of Iraq, on the State Department's website, where they talk about patterns of global terrorism, not a shred of evidence linking Al-Qaeda to Iraq. More importantly, in U.S. versus Bin Laden, and I'm sure you've read the indictment and you've looked at the transcript of the court case, which became the African Embassy bombing case, they actually list all the countries that are associated with Al-Qaeda. And this is, the indictment was in the fall of 98, and the case stood, you know, through February of 01. And they not a shred of evidence that there was a connection to Al-Qaeda. In fact, the most they said was that Osama bin Laden pledged that he would not attack Iraq. Well, that's hardly evidence that he's the puppet of Saddam Hussein. People have overlooked the fact that Blind Sheikh Rahman, again, if you look at Al-Qaeda is dominated, completely surrounding bin Laden, who's a Saudi of Yemeni origin. It's completely dominated by radical Egyptians. Dr. Ayman al-Zawahiri, who was seen recently in this latest video with bin Laden, Mohammed Attaf, believed to have been killed during the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, and Blind Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, they helped bin Laden mount what amounted to a coup d'etat, the takeover of the MAK, the Services Office Network, which was a fundraising network for the Mujahideen during the war against the Soviets.
Fundraising network for the Arab Afghans.
Richard, you make it seem, you actually make the statement in here, with Azam's help, Osama bin Laden opened the Bureau of Services. That's patently false. Abdullah Azam opened the Bureau of Services to fund the Mujahideen, and bin Laden took it over in a coup d'etat after he's believed to have murdered this guy and his two sons. He did not fund it with him.
Now you're talking about the credibility of my book. I think I've got the right to respond. First of all, I do say, I think a paragraph or two later, that Azam was killed in 1989 by a car bomb, and the Pakistani police believed that bin Laden's men were behind it.
Yeah, but it was a takeover.
And bin Laden was the beneficiary, so that's...
Right, but it was a takeover. It wasn't something that he funded.
Azam himself, in videotapes and in writings, credited bin Laden with starting the Bureau of Services, that what Azam was doing was mediating among the different Arab-Afghan factions. And maybe I ought to remind the listeners, there were two distinct fronts in that war in Afghanistan. One was composed of the Mujahideen. Those were the native Afghans who were fighting the Soviets. They had about seven factions. Then the second front was composed of the Arab Afghans, who were Islamic radicals funded by Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. And Azam was attempting to fuse them into one solid, coherent force. And bin Laden was key to that effort, because while he was negotiating with the military leaders and trying to keep people at peace, that bin Laden was essentially the quartermaster, creating guest houses, training facilities, food, and also, most importantly, a database of who all these Islamic fighters were, so that they could get letters home and things like that. So that he was working with Azam at that point. Azam was even the senior partner.
Yeah, he was working with Azam, but he was not a founder. And furthermore, you actually go out of your... Richard, you go out of your way to try and separate the U.S. government, notably the CIA, from funding bin Laden. You go out of your way. And your main source on that is our ex-CIA officials. You actually come out and say, Milt Bearden, retired CIA, has no motive to mouth an agency line. Well, anybody that covers intelligence know there's almost no such thing as a retired CIA agent. Bob Baer is one of the few honest ex-CIA agents that's actually openly criticized the agency. You just assume, Richard, let me finish. You just assume that No money went to from this $3 billion that Reagan poured into the fight against the Muj, which came in through the theater of ops, through Quetta and through Peshawar. There was a warlord called Gulbadin Hekmatyar, and Gulbadin Hekmatyar was joined at the hip with Blind Sheikh Rahman. When he became prime minister of Afghanistan later on, he offered...
That was years later.
No. At the time of the funding...
Wait a minute. Hekmatyar switched sides something like 11 times. Yeah. During some of those efforts, he even fought for the Soviets against his former allies, and 6 months later would switch back.
But it's so naive for you to actually think... Wait, Richard.
He linked with everyone in Afghanistan in those days because he changed sides
so many times. Richard,
from your point, sir.
Richard, you're asking the American public to believe that $3 billion in aid came into Afghanistan, and it was only given to those fighters who are not working with bin Laden. That's patently absurd. 500 Stinger missiles, according to Janes, the international agency that looks at military capability around the world, 500 Stinger, U.S. Stinger missiles got into the hands of the Afghan Arabs. I mean, and, you know, so they were allied with bin Laden. So you're...
And this was during what years?
This was throughout the 80s, but up until 1989, when the Soviets were ultimately dispatched.
So you're talking about the Reagan-Bush years.
I'm talking about the Reagan-Bush years. I think your first book should have...
The funding of the Mujahideen.
Yeah, which was the good war. The Democrats supported...
The Arab Afghans and the Mujahideen.
That Osama bin Laden was a beneficiary.
I know they were two separate groups, but...
Okay,
but
funding for the Arab Afghans came from the Gulf states and from Saudi Arabia.
Yeah,
bin Laden was funded by the Saudis from the beginning. The Saudis were funding resistance to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan far earlier than the United States was, and was funding an entirely different group for an entirely different motive.
You're actually... Richard,
I'm generalizing here.
You're trying to... Here's what you did. What you should have done is written one... The first book should have been How George Bush Lost Bin Laden the First Time, or How He Turned His Back on Bin Laden, because...
I'm not out to score ideological points like you are.
No, I'm not to score... You wrote an ideological book that was broken on Matt Drudge's report, and it's become the darling of the neocons. What are you talking about? You've taken journalism. Your book isn't a piece of journalism. You actually have statements like Clinton should have ordered many more strikes than bin Laden. It's a 300-page editorial for the neocons. That's what your book is. And I think what you've done is a huge disservice.
Now you're getting into personal attacks, Peter, which is a shame.
No, you're another journalist.
Thorough.
Richard, you're another journalist. I found between pages... You talk about your meticulously researched book between pages 75 and 85, 12 factual errors that I found in your book, okay?
Okay, but also you're very tendentious. I mean, you attacked me earlier for quoting Larry Johnson.
Right.
I looked in the index. I found that I quoted him once, and I was citing congressional testimony on the point of Ali Muhammad's double agent aspect, not on the point you raised about whether or not we had so many terrorists.
You also give the FBI credit for the seizure of Ramzi Issa.
Lori Milroy, and I just looked in the index of my book, and she appears twice, once on page 32 and again on page 326. So,
But you also gave credit. Look,
you need to read the book fairly.
I read the book fairly.
You are someone who feels very strongly about President Clinton.
No, I don't. I feel strongly about the truth.
People who feel strongly the other way about President Clinton. But,
Richard,
I have any strong feelings about the president.
Richard, don't extend me. I don't have feelings about Clinton or either of the Bushes. What my feelings are that in order to get to the truth of this unsolved murder, we've got to stop being political. You wrote a book that just was pandered to the right. I mean, that's what you did. You put blinders on. And you have multiple mistakes in the book. You actually come out and say the FBI was responsible for seizing Ramzi Youssef when it was absolutely false. If you'd even read the testimony in the Bojinka case, you'd know that he was seized by agents from the Diplomatic Security Service and the DEA, and that the FBI showed up 15 minutes later. The FBI took credit for it, as they often do, but this is the kind of multiple factual errors you have throughout all of your discussion,
The arrest was done by the Pakistanis with the U.S. standing offside there.
You say the FBI went into the room. Absolutely untrue.
They did go in the room after the Pakistanis had the seizure.
No, they didn't go into the room. Brad Garrett showed up 15 minutes later by sworn testimony in U.S. versus
Middle. Went into the room to gather evidence.
He went into the room. Yeah, but you make it seem in your book as if the FBI went in and put the bracelets on him.
And I never
that's
said
just
that.
Let me just ask something that goes to the core of what many people in the United States feel. There are two issues. One is the commission report came out, and Richard Miniter, you said that the Saudis were responsible for funding Osama bin Laden.
In the 1980s.
Right now, with this report that has come out, the 911 commission report, are you calling on Bush, as a journalist, to declassify the report, especially the area that implicates Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, of course I am. And
do you think this
administration classifies far too much? There's a classification culture that's creeping into American politics.
Do you think that Bush is protecting the Bush family's relationship with the Saudi regime, both his own and his father's?
Oh, I don't want to get into conspiracy theories. I don't know necessarily that that is what's motivating the Bush administration. I mean, it is the.
Do you think there are certain facts here
to support the case that that they have certainly done a lot of favors to the bin Laden family? One, of course, is which was spiriting them out of the United States following the 9/11 attack.
You going to cover Augusto Oil in your next book?
Of course.
Oh, good. But, okay. You know, George Bush, it can be fairly said, was in business with a man who was in business with bin Laden. I mean, that's pretty extraordinary.
Now, the other issue, most people in this country...
But the bin Laden question was not Osama bin Laden, but is one of his half-brothers. I mean, you know...
Let me just ask a question. Most people in this country believe that Iraq was connected to 9/11, that Saddam Hussein was somehow behind 9/11. Do you agree with this, Richard Miniter?
I don't think the evidence is there to make that particular statement.
Peter Lance, what do you feel in terms of that connection and Saddam Hussein's relationship with Osama bin Laden?
I don't believe Osama bin Laden. Saddam Hussein was what they call a secular Islamist. He was abhorrent to bin Laden and the blind sheikh. They put him after Israel and the Crusaders, which is the West. They put him third on their enemies list. And the idea that they had any association prior to the invasion is patently absurd. They've had 5 months on the ground in that country, Amy, to produce a single piece of evidence to prove that connection. And Paul Wolfowitz, if you read Bob Woodward's book, Bush at War, put the I think it was between 20% and 40% before the invasion, saying 20-40% likelihood that bin Laden was tied into the 9/11 attacks. I mean, that Saddam Hussein was. And here's the problem, okay? They used this justification to invade Iraq. You have a situation where Halliburton, the former company that was of which the vice president was the president of, got a $7 billion no-bid contract to clean up oil well fires in a country that wouldn't have had oil well fires if he hadn't been the architect of the policy to invade the country. I believe the invasion of Iraq has made this country exponentially more, the danger of this country has increased exponentially since the invasion. You have a virulent anti-American Shiite majority that could be democratically elected. You have a protracted guerrilla war. You have an $87 billion proposed bailout by Bush to justify the second biggest expenditure since the Marshall Plan. And you have these sweetheart contracts to Bechtel and Halliburton that if you had a mayor in a small town who had a construction company and his company got some kind of a contract to build a highway, no bid, you'd have a grand jury impaneled in most cities in America. And yet they actually got the American people amped up. Remember the Tom Ridge duct tape stuff going on in February? They got the American public so worried that there was an imminent threat to our national security from Iraq that not only has there been no evidence of the weapons of mass destruction that were imminently poised at America, which they allege, no connections to Al-Qaeda that have been brought to bear, but we now know that there have been actual lies in the intelligence, the uranium story. So, you know, the American public should really be demanding the truth, the full truth, the 12-year truth, not the truth that you tell in your story, which takes 8 years.
Peter Lance, former correspondent for ABC News, author of 1,000 Years for Revenge, International Terrorism and the FBI, The Untold Story, and Richard Miniter, wrote Losing Bin Laden, How Bill Clinton's Failures Unleashed Global Terror. That does it for the show. If you'd like to get a copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. I want to welcome Manhattan Neighborhood Network listeners, MNN listeners, Channel 34 to the new time, 8 a.m. in the morning. I'd like to welcome you to our website at democracynow.org. Today I'll be at Town Hall in New York with the Dalai Lama and others in dialogue. And tonight at the CUDI Grad Center at 7 with Greg Palast and WBI General Manager Don Rojas, Don Hazen, and John Nichols. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Pervez Sharma, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.